Hello, I'm Katie Manning, and you're very lucky because you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Enjoy!
This is Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up.
Welcome to episode 370 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where an evil robot is sent back from the future to alter the course of history, leaving a small group to defend themselves and hopefully preserve the safety of humankind for generations to come. Sound familiar? I'm Haley.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Kier. This week, Arnold Schwarzenegger declines a cameo role. More's the pity. But the liquid metal guy shows up later in the long-awaited Mary Shelley historical adventure, The Haunting of Villa Diodati. The TARDIS team are out there looking for that fateful night that Mary Shelley is inspired to begin her most famous novel, but something else is happening in that Swiss Lake mansion, other than the assumed hanky-panky, that is. We will take our initial reactions around the dial here and see what everybody thought of this penultimate story, I guess we could say, technically, right? I
mean, yeah.
The final story being technically a two-parter, so this is the penultimate. But okay, so Haley, what did you think of this modern Prometheus ghost story?
I really liked this episode, and I would argue that this is probably more like part one of a three-part story.
Seems to be, yeah. Jay, what was your hot take?
I thought this was fantastic. Like this is a proper Doctor Who ghost story. Like it. It had all of the creep factor that you wanted it to have, and a surprisingly compelling conclusion. So I just thought it was great.
Hmm. I have to agree, because specifically there were, in the construct of this, and a stunned that Maxine Alderton hasn't written, or hasn't been given the opportunity to write for this universe before, in some capacity. But she deserves some sort of award for the work that she did on here, because the dialogue is really tight, the background research and tying into Byron's and Shelley's writings and all of these wonderful references that are running throughout and really capturing some of the great personas of our characters and giving, as we will discuss in the next segment, what she has allowed Jodie to do definitely deserves a huge credo. So if we're all in agreement that this is right off the cuff, a really good, enjoyable story, you care to dig a little deeper?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Because sometimes this team structure isn't flat. It's mountainous, with me at the summit, in the stratosphere, alone. Left to choose. Save the poet. Save the universe. Watch people burn now or tomorrow. Sometimes even I can't win.
If we're talking about the ghost story elements of this, as we started alluding to last week, we knew that this was going to be another one of those instances where we are given what should, right on the surface, on any other show, be, supernatural, spectral, paranormal activity, and it always gets unraveled and proven to be something else. And that's kind of their thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems like our companions are expecting the same, or begin to get the same treatment, right? Ghosts aren't real. Yeah. So how did this particular spin on it work for you, as compared to some of the other ways that we have dealt with, even in the cases of Cybermen being, mistaken as ghosts and that sort of thing?
No, I thought that it was great, because you had you had a bunch of different elements that all kind of tied in together. You know, you had the flashes of some kind of figure in the house, things inexplicably moving, you know, with nobody near them. You had a haunted skeletal hand, you know, weird people showing up. It all served that this house is creepy as hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And none of it really seemed out of place. It all fit, you know, the storm raging outside and everything just amped up that creep factor. And you were waiting for the penny to drop. You knew that eventually we were going to get to something that kind of explained it. But it didn't, that didn't detract from any of the spookiness, you know, the house shifting and keeping people trapped in an area or something. It all worked really well. And then to have our explanation for, you know, everything going on, but then that little button at the end with Graham, like those two didn't fit into anything, and it just leaves that question mark that was just kind of like, all right, yeah, no, that deserves a rewatch.
Now, Haley, as far as as Jay's saying that we started getting, you know, sort of moment by moment little explanations of, okay, well, we're noticing this is happening because what was really going on was this, and this was happening because of this, and it seemed like they addressed with that one little caveat pretty much everything going on. How did the nature of those solutions, or at least those posited solutions, sit with you?
I thought they tied up everything pretty well, and it seemed like Graham was the only one that had things that weren't resolved. And did anybody else see the things that Graham saw? I can't remember. I only had time to watch the
episode. He was the only one that ever... those things were around, like they were in the periphery of other characters walking the house, but he was the only one that ever saw and interacted with them.
So it's just like, you know, Graham's losing it.
Possibly. I don't know. My take on that whole little final, you know, what two other people you saw, Graham, kind of a walk-away gag at the end, I think might have had something to do with the idea of what we've done with so long. The idea of energy being trapped in a location such that you, when you're manipulating time, when there's a huge amounts of energy being expelled and things, maybe that causes these visions from the past. You know, maybe Graham was just seeing previous occupants or the energy, the residual energy left behind by them. That's my take. But
or maybe we're going to come back to things that happened in this episode in the next two parts and we'll get answers to those questions.
Could be cool.
Yeah. It wouldn't be the first time they've done something like that with this show, but I tend to think that it's just an outlier. Just kind of, nope, we're just going to tag this on just to leave that question mark because it works as being spoopy.
Yeah. Well, and it adds a little bit of a smirk humor in there as well, which is, another thing that really struck me about Alderson's script here is that it balances that those icebreaker moments or the doctor being less socially awkward, less socially awkward and more really just giving us some really, really interesting reads on certain interactions with our other characters. The dialogue in this thing just hits every point so well.
Which, I mean, to be fair, when you've got characters like Lord Byron and Percy Shelley and things like, you have to have it. I mean, you really can't lack on the writing.
Yes. Yeah. And quoting themselves and quoting each other's works and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that is absolutely historically accurate, you know, because they were so enthralled with the creativity and the process of wordsmithing, really. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is totally accurate. As I did mention earlier, I think there was still a whole lot of, there was some sweet, sweet loving times going on in that chalet that we did not really get privy to.
No.
All kinds of the hanky and or the panky. But
yeah, if the doctor had walked in like 5-10 minutes later, she would have seen something entirely different.
Well, that's right. Well, they go busting in that room, and whether they're playing some sort of like you know, blindfold game and tumbling around the floor. Oh, okay, all right. And this is while Percy's missing, so they don't seem to be terribly distraught over him. I caught one thing. I'm sort of thinking through this episode chronologically, and in addition to the writing, I was really, really struck by Sigo Nakanola's score. Heavy mm-hmm. use of cello and really low register orchestration. And then there was one moment where, and I believe it's right about the point where the doctor's starting to figure out the perception filter, that she makes some sort of an ominous statement, and you hear what we have now established as the 13th Doctor's theme, but he changes it and does it in a minor key. And it was fascinating. Did you guys happen to pick up on that at all?
I did not. I'm going to have to go back and check that out now.
Yeah, you keep your ear tuned to it, and you will hear the exact moment it happens, because everything else, all other dialogue stops, all other characters leave the scene, like the frame is left on Jodie, and that plays. So it's like it punctuates it beautifully, and it just leads to what I thought was really, really great work on the score this week. We were talking about Jodie's performances and things, specifically how she deals with some, and there's like, we've got a handful of points here where we can look and say, wow, you know, she did this work in this scene and this work in this scene. But I wanted to talk to you guys about how she dealt with Lord Byron, the sleazeball, and that consistent tone and what she was given back every time he was trying to lay it down.
Yeah, the just not having any of it, and borderline disgust.
Yeah, borderline.
I mean, outright at times, but she kind of kept it.
Yeah, I'm really surprised she was able to maintain and be as diplomatic as possible. Probably, again, her desire to be part of this historic moment without disrupting the history of it. So maybe she doesn't want to pop Lord Byron in the mouth, but she could.
I thought that the line at the end from the other one, I can't even remember her name now, but I felt like that kind of...
Oh, about being used as a human shield and discarded, like, and then called upon again. Yep.
I mean, had that been the only thing that came out of this episode, I still think it would have been worth it.
Yeah. Haley, how did Jodie's performance overall through this? What were some of the standout moments as far as the way that she, this time around, this take on the Doctor with this writer's materials?
Well, yeah, shooting down Lord Byron was always fantastic. But also we got some of her, like, more powerful Time Lord-y kind of stuff happening. We got a lot of the psychic abilities of the Time Lord. That was fun to see, because we haven't seen a lot of that.
This is what I wanted to ask you guys, because this was something I've heard this now from a couple of folks over the course of this past weekend, as there was a live screening at Gallifrey 1, too. And by the way, it went over gangbusters. Everybody was just ecstatic over viewing the episode. Mm-hmm. But the mind meld, Vulcan mind meld, we've been getting that quite a bit this series in particular. Everything from the Time Lord contact to going in and mind probing. And now this idea of being able to give someone a view into the future. We're pushing canon here. Does anybody feel that this might be heading in a bad direction? Or are you okay with some of the new gifts or the heavy use of these gifts that we've been relying on a bit?
Doctor Who canon was meant to be fuddled with.
Honestly, I feel like this is a different wrapping around the same thing that we've always gotten. Because if you look back at previous things, like any other showrunner, any other writer probably would have done something very similar. They just would have used the sonic screwdriver to do it. And we'd have complained about, you know, this new ability of the sonic screwdriver. So I think the wrapping is new, but the problem is still the same.
Yeah, the sonic gets a lot of relatively, more practical use. We've come way back down from magic wand.
Yeah.
Way, way back. To sort of jump around a little bit here, you mentioned, Haley, about the fact that she gets some moments where she can really kind of throw down the Time Lord rhetoric a bit. I'm jumping ahead in the story, but when Ryan is trying to just give what he believes to be sort of the Occam's razor solution, you know, we offer up Shelley here and problem solved, right? We don't have to worry about the future of the human race. And we get something that's almost like a Fires of Pompeii, but darker response. How did that entire... Because it becomes a monologue. It really does. Mm-hmm. You know, from the flat team structure line and onward. And it's one of those things where we're going to go back and we're going to look at that as one of her best speeches. But, well, not even speech. How would you categorize this?
Response?
Like dressing down? Yeah. Well, she's like scolding them almost. Yeah.
I mean, and we've seen other doctors do this. Like, every once in a while, they come down and, like, you know, this is what it is to be the Time Lord. I'm the one that has to make mm-hmm. these tough decisions that you people can't make.
Right.
Well, and this is the first time that any of these companions have really gotten anything like this. You know, it's...
Yeah.
They're still relative babies compared to most companions at this point.
And they've been treated like the, well, going with the flat team structure sort of thing, and everybody has a voice and everybody has input on it. But the Doctor mm-hmm. has been protecting them very openly, as much as she's been guiding them and taking them, you know, opening their eyes to the greater things. Mm-hmm. But this is the first time where she has really slammed home not only the repercussions and the dangers of what it is that they do. It's mm-hmm. more than just a warning about, up, you know, no, don't mess with that, because that's going to be important to the future time stream sort of thing. It's far, much higher scale than anything of that nature. It's really pulling the brake and having that conversation. There's two things going on here. There's one about saying that you couldn't possibly understand how risky these kinds of changes can mm-hmm. be, and really laying into Ryan about the, you know, you want to wipe out your own existence, you know, and that sort of, you know, grandfather paradox kind of thing. But then the other side of it is really just a matter of, this is all of everything that she's had pent up about the other concerns that we've been wondering all season, you know, how is she processing the mm-hmm. the knowledge of Gallifrey and the Master and these things? And I don't think she can keep it in any longer. Like, this is the beginning of the crack.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was thinking too, was that it's like this, the strain is starting to wear on her, and this is pushing her towards the edge. And it did come across that way, and just it's all kind of becoming too much for her.
Well, and also something else we've talked about, this is kind of the companions being pushed away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I will say that I enjoy the fact that for once we have not run into a fixed point in time. Like, she is totally aware and terrified of the possibility of things getting messed up,
right?
And admonishing the companions to not do so, because, you know, this is a time that can change, and we need to make sure it doesn't.
Yeah, the distinction between, well, fixed point in time, things you cannot alter, versus things that you absolutely advisably shouldn't, because of, obviously, you know, your ripple effect. And I really like the way that it was laid out as well. You know, it's a matter of, for the viewer's advantage too. We may have viewers that aren't really well steeped in some of the things that we, as, you know, time travel program interested individuals, we've tinkered with all this stuff, right? You know, we've watched, all the movies. Heck, we've done podcast episodes here about related movies that have toyed with these things, like Looper and Bill and Ted's and...
Mm-hmm. Frequently Asked Questions.
Frequently Asked Questions was a great example of that sort of thing. But I think it was great to get to the point where what began as this kind of a funny but spooky, and I'm laughing, but I can't tell if I'm laughing because it's funny or if I'm laughing because my heart's kind of hammering a little bit, and it flips as soon as we start to get the real understanding of what's going on here. So let's take a look at that. I mean, we all kind of knew, watching through this whole season, we knew what was going to be outside there on the lakeside. Mm-hmm. That was trying to get in. But when we finally get to see Ashad and see how that character is portrayed, what do you think about a half-built Cyberman that still has some emotions but is still clearly insane?
It's terrifying.
Like, yeah, I think we needed it. We needed something new and creepy about the Cyberman. And
Because we haven't seen him since 2017, right? That was the last time we had Cybermen proper. Mm-hmm. Proper,
yeah.
Yeah.
It was the change that we needed to really renew them. You know, they weren't the Borg. It wasn't just this, you know, cold calculating machine anymore. It was like, oh, okay, you've got all the capabilities of the other guys, but you might just snap at any moment, and that's kind of scary.
Interesting that in this particular instance, we're dealing with someone, or we're dealing with an individual, whoever Ashad was in his in his previous existence, that began the conversion process before the emotions were turned off.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wondered, you know, wouldn't it be easier all around to shut that down first? You know, because was it a Army of Ghosts where we start to, you know, we interrupt the conversion process and seeing people that are slowly going insane as the as the upgrade is in progress, literally. Yeah, just gotta wonder. Yeah, just disconnect that first. You know, get your lobotomy done or whatever it is.
I don't know.
Now we got two things going on here with the portrayal of this lone Cyberman too, because our voice work is our beloved Nicholas Briggs, but the actor who we actually get to see that some of that facial expression, you know, as as creepy as hell as it is, by Patrick O'Kane, how did that work for you as far as getting being able to see throughout all of this and hearing from hearing Nicholas, but seeing the way that he would scowl or seethe or at times grin, which is really freaking disconcerting.
Yeah.
As the, as he's delivering some of these scenes, how'd it work?
I thought it was fantastic. It was that tiny bit of humanity left that really made it chilling.
Mm.
And the voice having the modulation and things like that, like, if there were instances where it was slightly out of sync, that kind of helped to mask it enough that I didn't notice.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. It's just, we talked about how it's kind of making the Cybermen a new villain, which they haven't been for a long time. And it's something new and creepy. And, you know, the part of humanity that's left in him is the very worst of humanity. That's what we're seeing.
Right.
So it's interesting.
Guys, the theme.
Did you notice that the his left arm had what looked very much like the Mondasian Cyberman, yeah, sort of under armor, I guess.
Yeah, I did notice that.
Cyber under armor. But it lent itself so well. I loved watching Mary Shelley through this as, you know, she's sussing it out and trying to figure out, oh, are you made of a composite of men? And just her decision to be able to address him or ask him of his name, because of as a means, both as a genuine inquiry, but also as a means of sort of distracting and disarming this this point of rage. But man,
right? Because I mean that's not something that you would have expected, or like I don't think the doctor would have thought to ask that, nor would I have expected her to. You know, it's just she's dealt with Cybermen so often, so many times, in so many different iterations that she's not going to think to ask that, because it never matters. It never functions. And here's someone that's encountered them for the first time, and she's like, no, I'm going to ask this question. And it, like, this is the one instance where it actually pays off to some extent.
Well, you think it is. And then when you finally get his fuller response, talk about adding to the creep factor. Now you want to know his backstory.
Mm-hmm.
What in the world really happened back then?
I wouldn't be surprised if we do get some of that later on.
Mm.
Yeah. Like, I mean, because clearly this is he is going to be the big bad, I feel.
Right.
Yeah, like, we might have other Cybermen to contend with, but I feel like he's going to be the one that is the linchpin.
Right.
So I wouldn't be surprised if we do get some of that story. But even if we don't, it's not, like, it served the purpose of, you know, filling in what we needed it to. And if we never get any more of it, then it we don't really lose anything.
You mentioned how the doctor responds very differently in all of her, you know, face-to-face interaction with this lone Cyberman. Mm-hmm. But that it goes back to what we were saying about sort of the interesting spin that she's been able to put on a number of her scene reads and interpretations in this episode in particular, is when he's kind of trashing the place, you know, looking for the Siberium. Okay, I'll give you Siberium. We've used Dalekanium, so we can have Siberium. That's fine. But he's trashing it, and as he's like smashing desks apart and whatnot, and the camera shifts its view, and you just see her sitting there on the edge of the bed, just watching him. Yeah, lots of luck there, buddy. That was, I think she clobbered that scene. I absolutely loved the way that she was just keeping it
that
cool
night,
through all
the. One instance that I can remember, like, actually laughing out loud was her, like, oh, no, this is great. Let's split up. You go search there, and I'm going to end, and just takes off running.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely love that one.
So Scooby-Doo. It's awesome.
Yeah, I love when they give Jodie any comedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think everything about a vast majority of her facial expressions and her demeanor and things have shifted quite a bit. I think it may be just indicative of working with this particular director, or maybe it's just where this was at what point in the production cycle, knowing maybe as viewing it, as you were saying, Haley, this is really kind of a three-parter, and maybe she being privy to the to all three parts of the story, if she was. I'm not really sure how she handles getting her sides handed to her and things, but maybe she knows that it's going to have to be something where she definitely shifts what she's been doing with 13 because of where they're headed. But it just struck me on nearly every scene. So I've rewatched it 3 times now, and I'm still picking up on things with every viewing. We get some answers, but we know that we're teeing up a larger story to follow. So we get to this approach of, you've got a horrible situation here. This is nearly a no-win situation. Mm-hmm. But the doctor's going to stand by the decision to save the one and attempt to save the many by, the step one. And step two is clean up all the mess that you made in step one.
Step two, question marks, question marks, question marks. Step three, success.
Right. Have we ever seen, it's a formula that the doctor has employed on numerous occasions, but it's never quite called out as bluntly as this.
Oh yeah, no, they've never confessed to that's what they're doing. Like, we've definitely seen it happen sometimes.
Sure. Yeah, we joke about, do you have a plan? Well, I have most of a plan, or what have you. But this isn't even.
But it's always played off as like, no, this is totally what I was going to do all along, and like this time it's just actually nope. This is I've got no clue.
How many other ghost story and similar kind of references were you picking up on as we were going through this? I'm just thinking it through. It's just the entire first act and a good chunk of the second act before we get into full sci-fi killer robot mode. There was so much going on there that. When we start to get the reveals and we find out that, okay, it was Percy. I keep thinking about Polly too and his sleepwalking thing, but anyway, but Percy wandering the house and trying to hold everything back while trying to be seen at the same time. But it, the looping house, I swear the only thing that I went to was the X-Files and how the ghost stole Christmas. Do you remember that episode? It was the one with Lily Tomlin and Ed Asner. It was a Christmas episode where Mulder and Scully go to find a haunted house where there has been a murder house for couples through time. And they get stuck in a room that keeps looping. But they're stuck in separate rooms that keep looping. They run out one door, come in the other side. Run out one door, come in the other side. And it devolves from there to the point where like Mulder finds his own body under the floorboards and whatnot. But that idea of the looping room thing, and they started doing that, I thought, God, this is a great little homage. But I loved the explanation, the fact that the haunting of the house itself was two sort of battling aspects of on either side of a perception filter, effectively, that neither side had control of, that there was this third element, this Siberium, that a sentient chunk of knowledge or what have you, that was trying to hold these walls up. I loved the way that whole thing unfolded. That was probably one of my favorite aspects of the entire episode, outside of some of the dialogue. But as far as the execution of the episode, I think I love that.
Yeah, no, it was so much fun. And this whole episode was just, it was chock full of things that I will go back to and compare things in the future.
Hmm. What does this then say for where we think we need to go? Maybe I'm asking for predictions, or maybe it's just for a matter of what you feel has been clearly teed up with where we're going with the episodes to follow.
I think some of the historical figures we've met this season are going to come back as part of the resolution.
Really? Like going all the way back to, Ada Lovelace and that far back, or?
Maybe. It seems like they've done a lot of historicals in a small time period, particularly this season. And it's hard to think that wasn't done for a reason.
Gosh. Oh, well, wait a second. We've been talking about the fact that we were dealing with all of these individuals who had profound impact on the advancement of computers and wireless technology, right?
So these are the people that get us Cybermen.
or have to have to be able to have to be some part of the solution path to getting us out of it. Either something was steering us towards it, and this is all the process, or we need to use this as the way to steer us out of it.
What if the Cybermen have been manipulating the timeline to result in their own creation?
Oh, dear God. We've been asking for so long for the Dalek time controller. We never considered the Cyberman time controller.
Yeah, yeah. And now I'm also wondering if all of these individuals the Doctor has been interacting with through all of these historical pieces are all adding up to be the Timeless Children.
Huh.
Insofar as timeless maybe being some sort of a spin on the idea that that their relative times had their own degree of importance, but they are of greater importance when they are taken out of the context of their natural time. Once they become timeless and work with the Doctor and Space Fam, that they collectively are the Timeless Children.
Listener, you're in luck. You're getting to listen to Kier's brain unravel in real time. It's fantastic.
I smell toast. yeah, that's okay. Well, you know, I wanted to try to get a rewatch in of some of our anchor episodes all along. So maybe I'll get a chance to do that before what this all wraps up on March 2nd. So
yeah.
Okay.
Well, sounds like we got a lot to go into.
We do. But interestingly enough, both connected to this conversation and leading into where we're headed in episodes to follow, I think we do have some bits of news that will relate.
Yeah, let's go ahead and jump into it.
So absolutely want to make sure that, because it's kind of tees up some of the things that that we will be talking about that have been, I say, in print, you know, pixels out there. but some things were discussed at this past Gallifrey 1, the 31 Flavors of Gallifrey 1 that just wrapped up a day and a half or so ago, depending on what time everybody left the lobby.
There's still people in the lobby.
There actually are.
It wouldn't surprise me, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't end up leaving the lobby until about 11 o'clock on Monday night. So, and there was still a considerable number of people that were sort of draped over furniture. So it was a rager, I guess you could say, but an immense overall reaction. I kept noting over the course of the weekend that everybody was so happy. It was just, the spirits were amplified to the nth degree. The fandom is really, really electric right now, and even as some people were noting, Nathan from the Pixel Who artists said that, yeah, even the folks that are normally grumpy and grumbling about everything don't have as much to grump and grumble about, so it just brings the whole sea level up a bit,
right?
So, but we had great opportunities to be able to meet Tos and Cole, who is a huge ball of energy and was running around without his handler half the time, because he would like come bouncing down a hallway and just kind of check out, and he'd like sneak up behind people who were taking photos in front of a TARDIS interior backdrop wall, and he would sneak up behind them to photobomb and things. So he was loving it, absolutely loving it.
Oh yeah.
But people did get some interesting conversations with him. To find out, Ty Gooden, our friend from over at the Nerdist, was able to speak with him and did kind of probe the question about this show that he's got stateside and what kind of impact it might have. He couldn't answer anything definitively, but the conversation's out there. Pearl Mackey finally got a chance to make it to one of these major cons when all of her conflicts had kept her at arm's length for at least 2 years. You know, we missed her at a few cons, and she was amazing. So happy to see everyone, and even though she was only there for a portion of the time, you know, Friday into, but everybody who got a chance to meet her was just bowled over. She is so sweet, and she loves this fan base with all of her heart, no question. But the individual who killed us over and over and over again was Christopher Eccleston. I had to express it in a tweet the other day, because when he had his second main panel interview on Sunday morning, it was his birthday. Mm. So you got, you know, 2,000 plus people in Hall A all singing happy birthday to him. And he started sharing things. We've heard from some of his other appearances on things like New York Comic Con and such. He speaks very candidly. He's very raw. Mm-hmm. And he made these crowds openly weep, like hundreds upon thousands of people crying their eyes out at him sharing things with them on a level that was, there was no way that he was doing it strictly for the sake of reaction. He was being absolutely genuine about it and saying things like, you know, you have made this one of the greatest birthdays that I can recall because of all the outpouring of love that's being given to him. Or saying things like this, you know, referring to the Gallifrey weekend, is the best convention experience he's ever had. And he genuinely meant it. And every time he would do that, he would just break everybody. Someone gave him an opportunity. It was during a sort of a slightly different format panel where he was doing sort of walking through some of his script material, sort of explaining his process of, you know, how he sort of, you know, took the Doctor's character apart. And he had a segment of the script from Father's Day where he's talking to the infant Rose. Mm-hmm. He ended up in his arms with one of the a baby that was in the audience, and he delivered the lines to the infant. Again, the room shattered. Absolutely shattered. So damn him. And damn him for the fact that of the thousands of autographs he signed, the autograph line, I've never seen it like this. It wrapped inside, outside, up the stairs, down, outdoors, into the car park. It was insane. To the point where even after closing ceremonies, he mentioned that he was going to go back to his table and do an unannounced additional signing so that the people who didn't get an opportunity to... And there was a mad dash. You saw hundreds of people sprint to go. But he was signing a good number of the autographs as Christopher Eccleston, IX. He would sign at 9.
Nice.
So really classy. But anyway, so all of that being said, and all of this energy, and all of these people who were just having a phenomenal time, and the cosplayers were having a great time, and the coffee clashes were fantastic conversations, and LobbyCon was fantastic, and the TARDIS talks, and all these things, and yet we still get yabos like, and I'm going to call this out. So, dear writers for and editors for WeGotThisCovered.com, please stop talking. Just stop.
Yeah, that's what I've heard from everybody. Like, we're not going to listen to you anymore.
It's freaking ridiculous about screaming that the ratings are so poor. It's the worst ratings since the show went off the air in 86 and on and on and on. I'm sorry. I just watched 3,000 people pour their hearts out and much money and time and energy and emotion into expressing how happy they are with the fandom right now. So screw you. Frankly, and then that particular writer who will not be named, but you can go ahead and search it on your own because we're going to put the link in the show notes. And I look at the other stuff that he writes, and he's just this salty, butthurt fanboy, neckbeard jacket. Oh, anyway,
does he have opinions about the new Star Wars trilogy?
Oh my gosh, yes, he does. Yeah,
yep. Sounds about right.
Sort of like 100 ways you could save the franchise now.
Ooh,
yeah. So, backing up a little bit, backing up to last week's episode. Remember we had the conversation towards the end because we were talking about the episode sort of chronologically and how it was very unusual that when Graham was having the heart-to-heart with the Doctor about his cancer remission and his concerns, mm-hmm. that her response was a little off?
Yeah.
A lot of the public didn't like that.
I wonder why.
Yeah, but to the point where BBC gave an official response.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have both of you gotten a chance to read this over?
Yes.
I have not.
Okay. So, Haley, we're going to call this up for you just so you can kind of get a take on this, because I think it's really kind of interesting, and it plays a little bit into what we were wondering if this could be the case. And they said the intention of the scene was to acknowledge how hard it can be to deal with conversations on this subject matter. And when faced with these situations, people don't always have the right words to say at the right time, and this can often lead to feelings of guilt. By showing the Doctor struggling to find the right words, the intention was to sympathize with all those who may have found themselves in a similar position. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, did we posit that potential take on it last week?
Something similar, at least. But, I mean, I will say that I can absolutely understand that, and I get it, and it makes a lot of sense, but the intention may have been there, but the execution fell short.
Mm. Right. Right. Yeah. And I remember you both saying that that was and that was something that was indicative to a lot of aspects of that particular episode for you personally, as far as your interpretation or your reactions to the episode, was that you saw some of the things that they were attempting to do, but weren't always 100% on board with how it was pulled off.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, with this explanation in hand, do you feel, Haley, do you feel that this is adequate as far as saying, well, this is what we attempted to convey and maybe it just didn't read properly?
I mean, I guess that's fine, but the end result is still a moment in an episode that did not settle well. Okay. Like, knowing what the attempt was doesn't change how you felt when you watched the episode and how you'll probably feel when you watch it again.
Mm. Okay. Having this explanation in hand on a rewatch might end up having me trying to look for more subtext. But again, yeah, if it's not something where you felt that it was accurately conveyed, then it's just...
My concern with it is like, okay, so you're trying to get on a level with people who have been in this situation, who didn't have the words to say, but how is this coming across to someone who has a condition that needed support, and they hear the doctor, like, you know, they've already had their friends be like, dude, I don't know what to tell you. Mm. And now you have the doctor being like, there's nothing I can say that's going to make this. It's like, how hopeless do you have to feel at that point? Like, you have to think of all the different angles that you're looking at this from.
As opposed to the doctor giving some response saying that I'm not the best person to talk to you. I appreciate you entrusting the information with me, but I am not the best person to answer for this, but I do want you to have this.
Yes, something along those lines that just, you know, more of a, hey, look, I may not know what to tell you, but help is out there and let me help you find it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like that would have gone miles beyond the way that it actually came across.
I agree.
Or she had said, you know, 5 minutes from now, I'm going to think of the perfect thing to say. Well, cut to that scene, too.
Yeah.
Right. And there, that's where you could actually have what Jay had just posited, the whole idea of 5 minutes later, she says, we're going to find the right individual that you can have this conversation with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shifting gears, Jay, what did you pick up on this? This next
Oh, yes. Level? Absolutely, I did. Yes.
Okay, good. So walk me through this.
So, I mean, the moment when the doctor is talking about the Cybermen and, you know, it's like all of the atrocities that they've committed and things that, you know, the horror of it. And she makes the comment of, I'm not losing anyone else to them. And I did. Like, I punched my thigh. I was like, oh, she's talking about Bill. She's talking about Bill. It was that instant recognition of, like, you know, she's acknowledging her past regeneration, her past companions, which is something we haven't really gotten much of from this doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from, you know, the offhanded comments of, like, you know, angry Scotsman or something like that. But, like, this was her acknowledging her past companions and the losses that she suffered throughout her lifetimes.
Right. Yep. So it was left intentionally, you know, not explored any further in the script, because we were in the middle of what I thought was a rather succinct summary of the concerns over the Cybermen. Mm-hmm. As the doctor is first introducing them to the companions.
Yep.
But yeah, I guess Jody was asked about it promptly thereafter. I kind of love all these interviews that happen, you know, within 24 hours of the episode's airing.
Mm-hmm.
And how you immediately start getting some behind the scenes featurettes out of these interviews. But she's like, no, that's the subtext we were going for. That's precisely who we were referring to. So, haha, right in the heartstrings. Sorry, we're not sorry.
Yeah. And I did see, it was a tweet or an Instagram post. I don't know if it was from BBC, like Doctor Who official, or if it was one of the fan things that I followed, but it pointed out, obviously Bill was a big one. It pointed out, Danny Pink.
Mm-hmm.
And the final picture at the bottom was Adric. And I was like, wow,
oof,
really going deep on this one.
Yeah. Yeah. We also have a little bit of news. This kind of emerges from the Gallifrey One discussion, but it's really sort of taken life of its own because it was something where they were letting people know that a big announcement was going to be coming, and the announcement was going to be made at this large Whovian gathering. And that's that big finish, because Jason Haygallery was there, and he always likes to come with some goodies in his briefcase. gave us the announcement that there's going to be more Eighth Doctor adventuring. Hey, fantastic.
Yay.
Love that. Can't get enough of that. You know, been loving the Ravenous series and such. But they're going to do another multi-doctor crossover, but not the kind of multi-crossover that you thought. We're bringing the Curator back into the storyline.
Well, I mean, he's got to come into the storyline at some point, right?
Some point, yeah. But it's... I think I'm really surprised that they haven't really done anything, because they have Tom Baker doing, you know, Fourth Doctor adventures with them right now. They, you know, they bring all the recording rig out to his home so that they can make it as convenient for him as possible. So now, but now we finally get to get this enigmatic character explored a little further.
I wonder who posited this as an idea first. You know, was this Big Finish like, hey, let's explore this character? Or was this Tom Baker like, you guys have me recording so much Fourth Doctor. Like, why doesn't this one be the Curator? You know, like, I'm curious how that process started and how it got posed and everything.
The wonder at the moment is whether this is going to give an explanation as to how the Curator comes about or fits in. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be taking place literally present day, 2020 London. So it's not as if we have to, you know, chase the character down into the, you know, to the ends of regenerative time or anything of that sort. I guess they went specifically to Moffat with a completed idea. They wanted to pursue it, and they wanted to get his blessings to be able to pursue it. So extremely pleased. I'm looking to the, they're going to call this the Stranded series. So, and we'll have Livchenka. So, you know, you can dial in there, Jay. This has got you covered. And we'll have some of our preferred Big Finish writers on that one as well. So pre-orders out there, and I believe it's going to drop, I don't know, 2021 or something like that. Who knows at this point? They've got so much stuff in the hopper right now. Who knows how long it's going to take before that actually gets into people's hands. But yeah, so I thought that was super cool.
Well, the last bit of news that we've got, though, is about Series 13. We may not have a solid date on when we're going to get that in our hot little hands, but they're going to start filming this autumn and have already confirmed the existence of a holiday special. Now, I don't know if that's...
Is it New Year's Day again?
The rumored discussion, because a lot of this stemmed out of a conversation with one of the producers who was at Gallifrey. And so she made the statement, it got tweeted around, it sort of got, you know, unofficial confirmation or that sort of thing, while we know that set selection, location filming and things like that have all begun already, that in June, that begins that's one sort of anchor point for getting the production cycle moved forward, and then principal filming in autumn of this year, with a slated, and this is going to come back to a kind of like one of these watch this space sort of things, for autumn of 21. The holiday special, which I think the conversation was saying that it had to do with, it was going to be released on Christmas, but not be themed in any way about Christmas.
What it's saying here in the article is there's going to be a quote, special episode to air at some point after Series 12 has finished, likely during the festive period. So totally vague, could be whenever, you know, nothing confirmed or anything, but
could be something they've already shot.
Yeah. But it's supposed to happen between Series 12 and 13. So this is going to come before Series 13 proper. So there's something to get us through.
Right.
We just don't know how long we've got to wait to get that little morsel.
Right. And then the production of Series 13 will have a holiday special of its own as well. Now I know that with the conversation that's going on about Tosin Cole's future with the show, I mean, because they've already shot everything like long while ago, and now they're sort of just, you know, working on additional projects. I know that they've been cornering Mandeep Gill about whether or not she's in any way involved with Series 13. Because that hasn't been confirmed, all kinds of things. But this is going to be, like, once we get beyond March 2nd, the question marks are just going to be flying.
Yeah.
Or maybe we'll have everything answered.
Oh, yeah, because that's just Chibnall's MO.
I'm hoping that even though now we understand a little bit more about how or why the embargo was placed. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that they have seen the error of their ways with the with everything leading up to this and the you know the upset from fans, and they will start to you know release things intermittently, even if it's just you know stills like production stills or things like that. Like,
right.
Give us something to get us through until the next episode.
Well, they have. I believe the job rec is down online. I believe they've hired somebody now in the BBC Doctor Who marketing department. So let's hope that they can get on it.
Mm-hmm. I'm Chris from Play Comics, a show where we look at video games based on comic properties and how well they stick to that source material. A part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other astonishingly geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
Next week, we're going to be coming back with the first part of the finale two-part. How do you phrase? I know words good. we're going to be coming back with part one of the two-part series finale, Ascension of the Cybermen.
Some of the promo photos are already out there, mm-hmm. So it looks like they're you know standing on a smoking ridge of a quarry. Hey, quarries! carrying a bunch of scrap parts, so they're either building their next Iron Man suit, or they're building good robot usses to fight all the evil robot usses. Station.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh no, this is gonna be fun. I'm interested to see where this goes, but. Anyway, this has been episode 370 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, his thoughts, his words inspire and influence thousands for centuries. If he dies now, who knows what damage will have on future history? Words matter.
And this is Kier saying, my bones have never caused such mischief before, I swear.
And this is Haley saying, come with me if you want to live.
We'll see you guys next week.
Annozzi.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2020. See you next week.